Hello everybody, this is Brian Murphy. I'm the Director of the Association of Clinical Documentation Improvement Specialists. I'd like to welcome you all to our latest ACTIS quarterly conference call. Just to recap for our new members and those who haven't participated in a call before, these are kind of unscripted calls with you, our membership, to talk with each other and with our advisory board. We have several members of the advisory board on with us for today's call. And be introducing them in just a moment, including four new members who I'm pleased to say we have three of those four on for our call today. I just want to let everyone know that at any time during these calls, which are again intended to be kind of a free and open dialogue, you can press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And when you press star 1, I will be alerted that you have a call, a question, or a comment, and I'd be happy to take that. If I can, we'll try to work you in the discussion. But please, at any time, if you have a comment on it, something we're discussing, or you have a question, I encourage you to press star 1. I'm going to start by first introducing some new members of our ACTIS Advisory Board. We have with us today on the call Glenn Krause, Jim Kennedy, Lena Wilson. I don't believe we have Gail Marini on the call, but she is also a new Advisory Board member. Just quickly to introduce these guys, and you can read much more about them on our ACTIS blog and also our advisory board webpage. But Jim Kennedy, you probably heard speak with many of our AHIMA, HC Pro Audio conferences. Jim is a managing director in the FTI Healthcare Group of FTI's corporate finance practice, which is based in Brentwood, Tennessee and Atlanta, Georgia. Jim is board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine, licensed in Tennessee. He's active in the HFMA and the AHIMA, among others. He's also a co-author of our new Physician Query Handbook. He's co-authored some AHIMA textbooks, including severity-adjusted DRGs, and we're very pleased to have him on board the advisory board.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate being here.
Okay. Our next new advisory board member is Glenn Krause. Glenn has a list of credentials a mile long, but he is an RHIA, CCS. He's also a CCDS. Glenn's an independent CDI specialist and reimbursement consultant. Glenn has a unique background. He's been a practicing coder, a consultant in DRGs, ICD-9-CM, charge masters, billing, APCs, E&M. He's done many, many blog posts and news articles with us, and we're pleased to have his expertise on board as well.
Yeah, thank you, Brian.
Okay. And I know we have Lena Wilson on. Lena is an MHI, RHIA, CCS. She's the HIM Operations Manager for Clarion Health in Indianapolis. She's been involved in all aspects of clinical documentation improvement since August 2005. In October of 2007, she was named Manager of all CDIP operations for Clarion Health. And in her current role, she manages 8 CDI specialists across 6 Clarion Health facilities located throughout the state. Welcome, Lena.
Thanks, Brian. I'm happy to be here.
Okay. And finally, I don't believe we have Gail on, but Gail Marini is an RN, MM, CCS, and LNC. Gail is a manager of clinical documentation for South Shore Hospital, right in our backyard, at Weymouth, Massachusetts. She's been the manager there for several years, and she started up a chapter well before ACTIS was started. It's called the Clinical Documentation Specialists of the Northeast Region. They've had me out to one of their meetings. She's very passionate about the field. She's currently also on the board of the AHIMA CDI work group. And I believe she'll be joining us later for the call, but we are very pleased to have Gail on as well. And just to let everyone know, Dr. Kennedy and Lena Wilson will both be presenting at our ACTIS conference in Chicago. So you can see much more of them there, as well as for our two new members. We'll have other board members presenting as well. Before we kind of get into some of the discussion we had planned for today, I just wanted to update everybody on a couple of association happenings. First and foremost, you probably have all seen we have our conference coming up June 3-4 in Chicago. We also have a pre-conference on June 2nd and a certification exam scheduled for Saturday, June 5th, the day after the conference. There are two important things I need to update you on. Number one is this year we've added a poster session, and we have a room reserved for the occasion. We can have up to, I think it's 11 presenters in the room size we've been assigned. You've probably seen these at other conferences. People bring their posters, and it's another way to encourage networking, to encourage education, and facilitate best practices and so forth. We're going to have some dedicated time on day two during the day two lunch to see those, and we're going to have our poster people right there to present them. The room will be open at all times. People can go in and view them. This was something people had been asking about, especially last year, so we are pleased to be offering that this year. The second thing I wanted to talk to you all about is we're currently having some hotel issues, which has been a challenge on our end. When we booked the conference, we weren't told, but there was another large national conference taking place at the same time. It's a group called ASCO. They're a large oncology association. Had we known this before, believe me, we would have picked a different time for the conference. That said, the rooms are still available. Our current room block at the Hyatt Regency is selling out quickly. I feel like a pitch man for our conference or something, and I'm just letting you all know that this is a real issue, that we are selling out rooms very quickly. We are working with a couple other hotels in the area, and we have been in touch with one that has actually cheaper rooms available right at the airport. About $150 a night, so it's cheaper than what we're actually offering at our existing hotel. The problem there is that I've been told it's about a 45-minute drive in, and we are booking transportation buses to take you from the hotel into the conference. So we believe we have it covered, and again, the rates are better for those who want to take advantage of it, but if you do sign up now, there is still availability at our main Hyatt Regency hotel. So again, I don't want to panic anybody, but that's just the way it is. And unfortunately, there are other conferences going on in Chicago, but there's a number of hotels, and we're very sure we can accommodate everybody. Finally, two other quick things before we get into our discussion. Number one is association-wise, we're again working on the certification. We're updating our certification for 2010. Our CCDS exam board is hard at work right now writing some additional questions, and we're going to be reviewing the existing questions to make sure everything is up to date. And kind of that version 1.2 of the exam, I'm calling it, will be issued for the first time at the conference, paper and pencil. So if you signed up for the certification exam now when you haven't taken it, it's still going to be exactly the same that you've seen in the handbook on the website. But if you're planning on taking it later in the year or at the conference, there will be a new version. It's still very much, you know, what you see in the handbook. There's just going to be some additional material on there as well as some updates to the exam. Finally, the last thing I want to talk to you about is our CDI work group. We have a group of about 12 individuals who have been working diligently to help develop some of the CDI benchmarks we all want to see about staffing, for example. How many CDI specialists should you have in your program? How do you monitor productivity and so forth? And we sent out a very detailed survey of about 50 questions to the membership. Many of you probably received that, and we did get several responses. We're going to be going over that report and kind of publishing some findings that we'll be sharing with our membership. Again, this is an effort to kind of try to benchmark some of those key productivity concerns and issues that there really aren't any guidelines for right now in this unique profession. With that, I'm going to talk a little bit about, and I'm going to ask our board to comment on some of the, as we were putting together kind of the agenda for this call. Again, these calls are pretty much unscripted and rough, but we do have some discussion points today, and again, I would encourage you, if you are interested in commenting on your own concerns, just by pressing *1 on your telephone keypad. But there's been a lot of talk right now about the recovery audit contractors, the RACs. On CDI Talk, for those who are involved, there's been some chatter on there about RAC requests. We had a recent RAC poll on our website, in which we asked, have you received any official medical record requests? We got 168 responses, of which 31 people or 18% said that they have received medical record requests. Another 19% said they weren't sure because their CDI department was not necessarily involved, and we realized that some hospitals have not made it a priority to involve their CDI department in this. But if you have had any requests, I think our membership as a whole is very interested in hearing about what types of records you've been requested, how many. I actually heard some discussion about a RAC contractor who was asking for records, you know, well before the 2007 date. So I would openly encourage our members, again, press star 1. You can dial in and let us know about your experiences. Did you have any comments on that, Tamara or Heather? I believe you guys may have received some requests, or you're on a committee at your hospital on the
program. Yes. Brian, this is Heather.
Okay.
We've recently received our requests around January 27th. Luckily this time, we have CGI as our auditor, and they've requested a total for our three facilities of 19 records. We panicked at first because we thought we should be receiving three separate letters because we have three separate facilities, but we realized that rule about the first three digits of the, I think it's zip code, if they're similar and within so many, same tax ID number, then they'll bundle it all together and you'll only receive one request. So luckily, we only ended up with two requests for 19 records. Our areas of focus, it seemed like, were sepsis, short-stay sepsis patients, extensive OR procedures unrelated was the other area that they requested records. We had some respiratory charts requested. All of them were aspiration pneumonia charts. We had some charts where the focus seemed to be, it's not listed this way, but it seemed to be what I found as a trend, single MCCs on cases. And then cases where the single MCCs were typically where the patient didn't stay past the geometric length of stay for that DRG. So
yep.
That was our main areas.
Nothing that really surprised you, you would say, Heather?
No, pretty much everything we kind of expected. Oh, we did have one request for an excisional debridement chart.
Okay. Yep, I know that was a big focus during the demonstration part of the project. And then how about you, Tamara, did you have any requests or are you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We're in North Carolina and Connolly is our RAC. We had a total of 46 records requested. They were all DRG validation reviews and some of the same ones that were just mentioned. The interesting thing, and I'd like to open this up for conversation, our letter actually requested any physician queries.
They did or they did not? I'm sorry, I missed that.
They did.
They did.
Request physician queries to be included with the medical record.
Yep.
Connolly's as well, or not Connolly's, CGI's as well. They had, on their letter, they had a list of documents and physician queries were included.
Yeah. I don't know if any of our board members can comment on that, but I know that, is that a matter of if it's in your hospital policy to include them as a permanent part of the record and they request the record, then obviously you'd have to submit the query. I don't know about those hospitals that choose not to include it as a permanent part of the record, you know, whether or not you're obligated to do that. It might be a legal issue, but...
We opted to not send them. Our policy is that the query is not included in the medical record. It is not a permanent part of the record. We ask the physicians to document in the record, and we take those query sheets out. We consulted with our legal department as well as Executive Health Resources, who is working with us on some of these, and we were advised not to send them.
Okay. Well, thanks, Tamara. I don't know if anybody else. I am showing some members who are calling in with some of their own experiences and comments. So. Unless there's another comment from the board, I would like to take the first one. And, Doug, could you put them through?
Certainly. Our first caller is Kathy Saluki. Please proceed with your question.
Hi.
Hey, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
We're in Maine, and our RAC is DCS, Diversified Collection Services, and we just got our first request about a week ago. It was for 7 charts. They were all DRG validation, and all of the charts were DRG, actually all of them but one were DRG 189, principal diagnosis of respiratory failure. And the other chart they requested was a trach for DRG 11. And I think the reason they requested it, although I'm not sure, acute respiratory failure was a secondary, but it was the only MCC.
Okay.
I think that may be why. The other thing we noticed is that 189 was not a transfer DRG, and all the patients went to either skilled or home care.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know if that perhaps had something to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it obviously those one MCC claims are probably standing out like a, you know, that seems an obvious target, but that's interesting. Thanks for sharing that, Kathy.
Yep.
I think we have one other person who might have a RAC-related matter they want to talk about. Could you put them through, Doug?
Certainly. Our next question comes from Don Pecon. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, this is Don. I'm calling also North Carolina. I had sent a somewhat long summary of analysis that I did from the 87 charts that we had requested, also with Connolly. And you know, the distribution of what we had was very similar to what others have talked about. The sepsis ones were all 1 and 2 day length of stays, with no patients that expired in that time frame. And one of the things that I think we had a fair number of single CCs, not MCCs, but single CCs. And some of those, in hindsight, I think were somewhat problematic. In that, and when I looked at them, I have the sneaking suspicion that they are going to get overturned, and we won't have a whole lot of defense on a few of those. Kind of echoing what everybody else has said, I think, as far as content.
What leads you to believe that, Don? If you don't mind me asking, was it just there wasn't enough supporting documentation in there, or is it?
There was one where I think the principal diagnosis should have been more specific. I'm trying to remember if it was ischemic colitis. And they used something as a CC that if they would have used the PDX of ischemic colitis, the CC would have been included in the principal diagnosis or excluded as a CC. It was they went with colitis with GI bleed as a CC, and it probably should have been ischemic colitis. And there was one other that used GI bleed as a CC that, in hindsight and re-review of the chart, should not have been used as a CC.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's kind of amazing what you learn when you go back and look at some of these things and you scratch your head, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, out of the 87 cases, 60% I felt pretty okay with. 20% I anticipate a recoupment attempt, but we'll have a decent defense on it. 20% it'll be anywhere from a not very good to no defense.
Yep.
And about 12% of the total DRG payment on the 87 cases, I think, are at a pretty good risk of losing.
Okay.
But that's buried in the CDI. Sent my email out on February the 11th if anyone who's listening wants to dig it up and look at any more detail.
Was that in the CDI talk group?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, I would encourage, I have figures on who's in CDI talk. We have over 200 people who subscribe to that list. Of course, our membership list is probably 1,700 at this point, so if you're not using CDI Talk, it's a free part of your membership. It's just a matter of going to the website. There's a tab on the left that says CDI Talk. You click that. There's a gray button on the screen that comes up that says subscribe. You do that, and you will be on the list. You'll be able to kind of access the group as well as send in your own questions and comments. I encourage it. Lately, it's been getting 25 to 30 posts a day from various members, so a nice feature.
I'll vouch for that. I found a lot of the conversations interesting and some of them extremely helpful.
Oh, I appreciate it, Don. Thanks for sharing your comments. Any comments from the board on anything?
Yeah, Jim Kennedy here. I'd like to, first of all, may I say something, please?
Sure, go right ahead, Dr. Kennedy.
Just first of all, I just want to tell everybody out there that I feel the pain that you're going through, and as you get these RAC requests, I'm certain that there's fear that's coming up and insecurity and, oh, I'm not perfect and we're going to fail and things like that. If there's any role for clinical documentation improvement, this is exactly why CDI is so important. And just the fact that we're looking at the records directly, we're helping physicians with definitions of terms, making certain that the what they write in the work, write in the records, is supported by credible literature that supports that definitions of terms. And just the fact that we're helping standardize the language, get it documented in the record, and coded correctly is absolutely crucial to our mission in CDI. So if there's in the reviews that I've done in the past, the reason that we lost was that there was a violation of coding rules. Either the rule wasn't followed or the clinical documentation wasn't in the record that supported the code that was coded, and it needed to be reversed because it was not done right to start with. So I just want to just share some hope with everybody that even though there may be fear that comes from this, even though there may be insecurity, this solidifies why we're here. This gives us a reason for telling our administrations of why we should look at these. And a good lawyer knows the law. The best lawyer knows the judge and the jury. And learning from this helps us grow in our CDI practice.
Thanks, Dr. Kennedy.
Hey, Brian. It's Pam Lovell. I would just like to add something to what he just said. I think that makes perfect sense. And I think, too, that this highlights one of the issues that we often hear in the CDI world is that when these audits come, it is about what is coded. And as we see CDI nurses and HIM and CDI specialists who are also HIM folks, we always have to remember that what we would like to see and how we would like to make the rules get what we need, we always have to go back to the pure chart and what the rule says. And I know that's often a point of stress in hospitals all across the country.
Yep. Thanks for sharing that, Pam. I didn't know you had joined us, but I appreciate it.
Brian, I'd like to add one other point.
Go right up.
One of the things that I'm seeing that's disturbing in the RAC issues is not just – remember that RAC is not just Medicare. There are – private insurance companies have hired different companies to do, in essence, a RAC-like responsibility. One such company is Healthcare Recoveries in Louisville, Kentucky. Many of these types of companies will actually challenge the definitions of terms so that even though a physician may have documented a record, even though the clinical criteria may be there, there will be medical directors or nurses that work for these companies that will say, well, the patient really didn't have that condition, even though we defined it correctly, we queried correctly, it was documented and coded. Other areas that I'm dealing with is that one company will disregard a code because it was documented throughout the chart but not documented in the discharge summary.
Mm-hmm.
And the rule of, you know, this to me is a complete violation of ICD-9 rules where the only time that we cannot code a diagnosis is if it's an uncertain diagnosis that's not documented at the time of discharge. But certainly established diagnoses, especially by an attending physician or a consultant, can be coded unless there's conflicting or other reasons not to.
Mm-hmm.
So we are encouraging folks that we know to get their legal teams involved, look at contracts, stand by the rules, and if we follow the rules, fight for this. And I'd just like to encourage others that are listening to this to bring their experience to us.
Yeah, Jim, if I may jump in, Brian also.
Yep, sure, Brian.
We have CGI. I'm in Pennsylvania right now, and we have CGI. They're not part of the MIC, but they have a contract with the medical assistants, and they're going back 5 to 6 years. And I have a case on my desk here I'm going to try to appeal, and I'm just as a matter of principle. But we had a patient come in. This could be, I can see the RAC doing this also. Patient came in, had a recent surgery for what was thought to be a ovarian cancer, but turned out to be a lymphoma 3 weeks prior, and came in with worsening 3 weeks, so 3 weeks passed, and she had worsening abdominal pain, got to the point where she couldn't handle it. We sent to the ED. Doctor thought it was a small bowel obstruction, treated, and certainly presented with signs and symptoms, temperature, white count, shaking, chills, but wasn't septic, and had abdominal distension. X-ray was, the radiology workup was suggesting, but not definitive, possible small bowel obstruction, and we got a denial that said there was no need for patient admission. Everything could have been worked up as an outpatient. There was no small bowel obstruction. So the doctor documented SBO throughout the entire record, including the discharge summary, H&P progress notes. And they're saying that the doctor who's reviewed the record is making that clinical determination there was no small bowel obstruction. So I'm not sure if we're going to see something like that with the RAC, but you need to be kind of vigilant about fighting those.
Yeah. I'm always amazed by that there is another doctor out there making those determinations from afar, and it's just something you have to deal with. But makes it very challenging. I think we still have one more person in the queue with a RAC related issue. So why don't we put them through, Doug? I solicited some questions in advance of the call, and we did get a number of them. So I'm hoping to work through some of those. But while we're still on the RAC issue, let's take our last call, please, Doug.
Our last question in queue is from Danietta Henry. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, this is Danietta Henry from McLaren Regional Medical Center in Flint, Michigan. Our RAC is CGI, and we just received our letter of request on February the 4th, and we were requested to send out a total of 20 records in relation to extensive OR procedures unrelated to the principal diagnosis, and a variety of respiratory system DRGs and the major joint replacements. And so we've not gotten any feedback as of yet, as I know, but our CDI program is involved with the RAC process. We actually have a RAC team here at our facility that involves UR, CDI, our quality department, and we have a couple of physician advisors on our team. We've not, as far as I know, we have not used our legal team so far, so I will make that recommendation that we get them involved. But in regards to the permanent, the query forms being a permanent part of the medical record, we do have our forms as part of the permanent medical record here at our facility, and we were told that even if they weren't part of the permanent medical record, that we were required to send them to the RACs. I know I heard one facility state that they decided not to send them, but I'm not sure where the resource came from, but we were told that even if we weren't, we had to send them. So.
Well, yeah, I know it's I haven't seen any definitive guidance one way or the other, and I just know it's being discussed, and that might be something that, you know, actors can look into a little bit more. Again, it might be consulting with a legal attorney. But
well, Dr. Kennedy here, the issue with the query is not so much that there was a query. The query, what the RAC, I think, is looking for is whether the query was leading or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really, and that's been the California experience, is that if a query is deemed leading, can the RAC disqualify the answer, you know, that was given? And I would just, and we'll just say that it's controversial, you know, what's leading, what's not leading, whether a concurrent person can suggest a diagnosis, you know, to a physician, or do we need to follow the AHIMA practice briefs, which allow the multiple choice options unable to be determined or other. So that's really, I think, going to be the issue with queries, is whether a reasonable individual, and again, the key word is reasonable, will deemed that that query was leading, and was the reason for the query, just to clarify what AHIMA has outlined, was the documentation illegible, inconsistent, ambiguous, incomplete, or conflicting?
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we follow industry standards that have been established and can show which part of that documentation required the query, I'd be proud to show that to anybody.
I agree. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I think that that was kind of our last RAC-related call.
Hey, Brian, it's
yes.
Heather. One last thing that I will caution you of.
Yep.
When we compared we put all of our requests, because you know how they said that they can't request it for another Medicare entity, or they've already reviewed the chart for something else, they're not going to request it again, or I'll be glad to request it again. And we did have one case that was requested by CERT prior to the request from RAC. We've called CGI to ask them for feedback on that, and I'm not sure. I personally didn't call, so I haven't received the feedback yet. But you might want to make sure, if you're getting requests, that you have some way to keep track of other entities that have requested it, and your RAC will supply you with a list of those entities if you ask them for it. And then that way, if you keep a database, you can determine if it's already been pulled and reviewed and appealed and went through that whole process, so that you don't have to you can just let them know that, so you don't have to give it to them again.
Hmm. Okay. Thanks for sharing, Heather. At this time, I'm going to, as I mentioned a moment ago, we did receive a number of questions from our audience prior to the call that were pre-submitted. And what I'm going to do is just kind of walk through some of these. If you've asked the question and we haven't clarified it enough and you want to call in, please feel free. If these spark a question of your own, I encourage you to dial in. But I'm going to try to get through some of these. Why don't we start with the first one? So this first one I sent to the board prior to the call, but I'll just read it out for our audience. It was a question about how other CDSs capture alcohol withdrawal in a patient not primarily admitted for alcohol detoxification. Example was a patient who's admitted for a medical or trauma primary diagnosis. The history reveals active alcohol abuse. So the physician orders a frequent CIWA, or Clinical Institute Withdrawal Assessment, with Cerax dosing for alcohol withdrawal. The patient is assessed frequently per protocol, but because of various reasons, i.e. IV narcotics, 1 or 2 day length of stay, or leaves against medical advice, they may not actually receive any of the Cerax. And they mentioned that coders in this facility do not capture alcohol withdrawal as a CC without documented Cerax administration. Well, there's some, there's a coding CDI conflict there to some degree. And the question was, does the use of the term alcohol withdrawal with monitoring and assessment only provide a sufficient basis to capture alcohol withdrawal as a CC, provided there's documentation of this monitoring and assessment in the record? I don't know if any of our board members could weigh in on this. And, if they have, you guys, I know this might be a hospital policy type of a thing. It seems like they have their own with the documented administration of that drug. But any comments on that?
Dr. Kennedy here. Coding is based on explicit physician documentation. And to the extent that a physician observes a syndrome, documents that in the record, and actually states that the patient is in alcohol withdrawal, then that should be coded. And as we know, alcohol withdrawal is a CC in MS-DRGs. It in of itself does not carry any weight in the APR-DRGs, which is used in other states. So if the physician documents alcohol withdrawal, and remember the guideline for an additional diagnosis includes patient monitoring.
Yes.
Not just medication, not just length of stay, but patient monitoring, and there is a physician diagnosis of this. Adding that as a secondary diagnosis is appropriate, whether or not it's a CC. Now, a potential CDI opportunity may occur, whereas if the patient does have an acceleration of their symptoms with alcohol withdrawal and develops delirium, there is a different code for that, which is, 290.0. And what is different about that is while it may be a CC in MSDRGs, it has higher weight in APRDRGs with an SOI of 3 and an RLM of 2. So being careful to assess the patient's mental status, if there is alterations of mental status, not just the jitters, that may be further clarification may be necessary.
Okay. Any of the board comments from that? Or?
Brian, this is Tamara. We've actually had this conversation with our coders here as well. And just like he was saying, monitoring is treatment, and we've kind of had to remind them of that. But just the fact that we had this, the CY protocol initiated is treatment. And so our coders actually will pick it up if they can see that.
Okay. All right. I appreciate the answer, guys. Move on to our next question, which we received. This is another one about multiple options on a query form. So this one was very interesting, I thought. It was, our CDI specialists tend to ask questions that provide the physician with multiple options to choose from, you know, which is what the HEMA brief advocates. It's not uncommon to have a query with multiple answers checked by the physician. So a good example would be, what is the cause of the patient's syncope? Options for the cause of syncope given are cardiac arrhythmia, anemia, and other. The physician then chooses all options given and also writes in dementia. So in this case, would it be appropriate to choose any of the options as the principal based on the following guideline? And this is cited from the ICD-9 guidelines, two or more diagnoses that equally meet the definition for principal diagnosis. In the unusual circumstances, when two or more diagnoses equally meet the criteria for principal diagnosis, as determined by circumstance of admission, so then diagnostic workup and therapy provided in the alphabetic index, any one of the diagnoses may be sequenced first. So, but then the other question they had was, or would it be more appropriate to code the syncope first, followed by the chosen diagnoses based on a symptom followed by a contrasting comparative diagnosis and that guideline. When a symptom is followed by contrasting or comparative diagnoses, symptom code is sequenced first, and all the contrasting comparative diagnoses should be coded as an additional diagnosis. So we have kind of a heavy-duty coding question, sequencing question. I don't know if any of our folks on the board who might want to weigh in on that, who know those guidelines pretty well, or might have some advice for that one.
Brian, this is Tamara. Syncope is a symptom. In this example, syncope should be sequenced first.
Okay.
Because it's a symptom code.
Yep.
Now, if it were not a symptom code, the previous one would apply. The first one would apply.
Okay.
Hey, Tamara, this is Heather.
Yep.
In this situation, though, it's not an or situation. The way I read the question, it's where the doctor's saying all of these things are causing the syncope.
Oh, I'm with you. Okay.
So in that situation, if that's the case, I mean, if he's saying, I don't know which one of these it is, I'm not sure the patient has any of them, then I would agree. But if he's saying all of these things, these diagnoses contributed to the symptom, then in that situation, it does go back to the two or more interrelated conditions, and then you have to figure out, treatment-wise, what was the focus of care or what caused the admission to the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah, Gail Marini, who I don't know if Gail has joined us on the call, she had mentioned earlier and emailed to me that she said it felt like an issue with the query process and physician education. She said linking a diagnosis to the symptom of syncope should be supported by medication changes, treatment plans, or medical intervention. Checking off several diagnoses offered on the query is a clarification opportunity with the physician, not a coding guideline issue. So it might be, where they should be, going to the physician in this case. Glenn, were you going to comment on that?
No, I was going to say the first thing I would do is just to validate that the doctor wasn't in a hurry and just checked off a bunch of these to get on to the next patient. just like this was mentioned earlier, to validate was it something that the doctor was really considering based on management, medical decision making, and so forth, because we don't want to get caught in the fact that the doctor said, hey, could be any of these, but in reality, was he really thinking truly it was based on the clinical presentation and the management of the patient and evaluation and monitoring and workup.
Okay.
Because I've seen, you know, several cases where doctors, you'll say, he might check off two or three, but when you look at it, you're scratching your head, saying, if he checked off pneumonia but no antibiotics, well, what's the deal with that?
Well, and it's Pam Lovell again. I think these sorts of examples are good reason why checkoffs are like a closed-ended question, in that you don't necessarily get the best answer, you just get an answer.
That's right.
Because often if you will say, what is the syncopal treatment directed at, he will tell you, because he knows why he's chosen one modality or plan.
Absolutely.
Over another.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And then, Dr. Kennedy here, syncope is of any diagnosis of in symptom within CDI, syncope is, I will find to be one of the more problematic.
Yeah,
one out of three have no etiology that can be discerned by the physician. You know, so we're left with the syncope. And in, especially in elderly patients, many of which are on Medicare, the reasons are multiple. So therefore, the ICD-9 rules of symptoms followed by multiple diagnosis, a symptom followed by contrasting comparative diagnosis, the symptom code is sequenced first, is unfortunately a reality with syncope. However, you know, I'm again open to suggestions from other members of the board. How would we best approach syncope yet still remain true to the gestalt of clinical data integrity?
I don't know if anyone on the board can address that, but
the way I find it is that I do try to see if there is anything that is predominantly present. Like, for example, if I'll see non-sustained ventricular tachycardia, you know, on electrocardiogram, then, you know, this is, again, where just having a discussion with the physician or engaging our physician advisors and developing physician awareness of the differential diagnosis of syncope and standardizing its assessment may be helpful. But again, syncope is extremely difficult, and those of us who are listening to this call that struggle with syncope, welcome to the club. I think all of us are struggling with that at this time.
Mm-hmm. I think we have a couple people in the queue that might want to have something to add to this discussion, or perhaps they have another question. I'm not sure. But, Doug, do you want to put one of them through?
Certainly. Our first caller is Robin Caney. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to add a comment, too, about that type of query for multiple responses to a symptom diagnosis. It almost seems like a verbal query would be better in that case, so that you don't have to keep going back to the physician to say, did you mean and all of these conditions are responsible for the symptom, or did you mean possibly each one of these might be causing that symptom? So the written query, unless it's crafted very carefully, probably would cause more problems in this situation than a verbal conversation with the physician.
Yeah, that's very good. That's a great point to make, in that, you know, there are some instances, as you said, Robin, where that verbal conversation is a much more effective way. I know it's not always possible, but whoever submitted that question, they may want to consider that as another option.
Hey, Robin, can I ask a question of you, please?
Sure. Who's that?
This is Dr. Kennedy. What is your facility's understanding of the coding of uncertain diagnoses? Do they have to be documented at the time of discharge in order to be coded, or can we code those if they're documented anywhere in the record?
Well, I'm not with a particular facility. I'm a consultant, and my advice would be to look to determine if that was ruled out throughout the notes, and that's another problem with the documentation. Things just kind of drop off the page as you go through the progress notes, never to be spoken of again, and coders get confused. Should I code it or shouldn't I? And some will argue and say, well, they never said they ruled it out, so I'm coding it. So again, another opportunity for clarification. If you're asking me should it be documented in the discharge summary, I have some really strong feelings about the reality of what's in discharge summaries and what people would be hopeful for. Often the docs don't carry every diagnosis into the discharge summary, and so many hospitals are now coding without that to not cause delays in billing. So I kind of take the stance that the discharge summary really shouldn't have any new news with the exception of ancillary testing that wasn't finalized at the time the last progress note was written. So a perfect consultant response, huh? It depends.
I'd like to suggest that everybody on the call open up Coding Clinic third quarter 2005, page 22. Coding Clinic third quarter 2005, page 22. Probably gives the best answer to this dilemma, and this I think is consistent with the guidelines as they've been amended since 2000, at least since 2005.
Okay. Yeah, for those who don't know, Dr. Kennedy's actually been doing some work with us, kind of summarizing the coding clinics with a focus on what CDI specialists should know about them. And those are available on our website under the CDI Journal tab.
Dr. Kennedy, I don't have that right in front of me. Could you give us a quick synopsis of the bottom line of that coding clinic?
Yes, ma'am. The coding clinic, third quarter 2005, page 22, the question is as follows. The attending physician for an inpatient admission has included conditions listed with the terms such as consistent with, compatible with, indicative of, suggestive of, and comparable with in the final diagnoses. How should these be coded? And, of course, they make the comment that uncertain diagnoses, you know, may, unlike outpatients and inpatients, uncertain diagnoses may be coded if documented at the time of discharge. The last sentence is what's very important. This advice should not be applied to admitting or interim diagnoses. And this is where I think CDI specialists have a really special role in that while I as a physician may not be able to absolutely rule in a certain condition because the diagnosis is based on my clinical gestalt, yet I don't want to stick my neck out by saying the patient has X because I don't have a lab test or something that could be refuted in court. So I want to waver a little bit, questionable, likely, suspected, so on and so forth. This coding clinic's last statement says, this advice should not be applied to admitting or interim diagnoses, and thus the term documented at the time of discharge is, I think, an area where CDI specialists need to be certain that if a physician is hesitant, reminding him of his or her responsibility to document their uncertain diagnoses at the time of discharge helps coders fulfill this coding clinic.
Okay. We appreciate that, Dr. Kennedy. That was a very helpful reference. I'll just summarize quickly. We have about three callers left, and I'm showing about 10 minutes left on the call. So there was a few questions submitted in advance that I think I can address briefly. One of them was about we're getting hit with patients who were readmitted in the 30-day time frame. Does anyone have any good system they're using to address this issue? You know, Glenn shared a great download, a free download, which is now on the ACTIS blog about that issue. Kind of a case management type of issue as well, and for those that are kind of have both hats on. But Glenn did provide a nice reference for our person who had that particular question. Again, if you go to our ACTIS blog, you'll find a PDF document that addresses that. So I do appreciate you sending that in, Glenn.
Thank you.
Somebody else, our next question that was pre-submitted was, we've gotten this question the last couple calls, and I'm pleased to say we're going to be able to address it in the next CDI journal, but it was a question about, does anyone review current newborn nursery and a maternity records for CDI? What issues do they look for? Any query opportunities? We've been working with a Dr. Pam Benson, who's going to be speaking at the conference, not on that issue, but she has some familiarity with the issues that face reviewing for those type of records, and we're going to be having an article on that in the upcoming CDI journal. So, if anybody has any opportunities they wanted to share with me offline, I would encourage that. And I am showing we do have about four people in the queue, so we'll try to get to as many of those as we can. And Doug, do you want to put our first one through?
Certainly. Our first one comes from the line of Susan Case. Please proceed with your question.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Susan. Okay,
thanks. It was our query, I believe, for the syncope, and we offered several choices because all of those choices had been documented throughout the progress notes. In fact, if I recall, several times it said syncope multifactorial. I appreciate the physician who was saying you'd have to worry about someone checking off several, because I've worried about that in the past. But in this case, I don't think that he did, because he also entered another diagnosis under other. So in that case, how does the group feel about how we should proceed with coding? And also, secondly, two other problematic symptom diagnoses for us, chest pain, altered mental status. Thank you.
Laughing.
Join the club.
Heather.
Hey, Heather.
I just have one question for her before she gets off. Were all of the diagnoses determined to be established at the time of discharge that he listed off?
Correct.
Okay. And you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, because this is a complex issue, but my feeling is if they're all established diagnoses, then it is the situation where they're interrelated conditions and you can select whichever one was the focus of care, or if they're all equally the same focus of care, then it's the highest weighted DRG.
Thank you.
Okay. I appreciate that, Heather. I know that is that's a complicated issue. Any other comments from the board before we take our next caller on that?
The coding guidelines say that when a symptom is followed by contrasting comparative diagnoses, the symptom should be coded first, and all contrasting comparative diagnoses should be coded as additional diagnoses.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. Kennedy, and thanks for weighing in on that. Why don't we take our next caller, please?
Our next caller comes from the line of Kimberly Richard. Please proceed with your question.
Hey, Brian, it's Kim.
Oh, hey, Kimberly. I know you had sent a question or two in before the call.
Yeah, that's okay. Now I have new ones.
Okay.
Hey, I guess our first dilemma is we had a meeting with our coders last couple of weeks, and they made a statement of if the physician documents anything, any kind of diagnoses, they are obligated to code it, whether there's evidence or not, just because the physician wrote it. Now, we won't query if we don't see evidence of anything, whether it's sepsis or something as simple as, I don't know, hyponatremia, let's say. If we don't see it, we are not going to query, and it's kind of like we get hit because they had coded it and had to do a retro or whatever. But, you know, our dilemma is just because the physician wrote it, does it have to be coded?
Yeah, that's does anyone on the board have a comment on that? I guess, so there's no other evidence of
any
clinical indicators of that diagnosis in there? It's just the
physician writes it. They have to code it.
Dr. Kennedy here. The AHIMA practice brief on managing effective query process that was published in October 2008 pretty much scripts the coder of any real teeth in questioning a physician's judgment. You know, so if a physician establishes a diagnosis throughout the medical record and there is no there's no hesitancy, you know, it's not uncertain in any way. They're kind of caught in a bind.
Right, right. And that's how they explained it. But our fear is they're even going to query for a sepsis, and we don't see any evidence of it being a clinical person.
Right.
So, of course, on the front end, we're not going to query for that. They query on the back end, and the physician might say, yes, it's sepsis. And then let's say that one gets hit for a RAC. Well, that to me is not right.
This is a huge issue, especially with what I've told you earlier with certain RACs, especially for private insurance companies.
Right.
Gauging physicians who will second guess the clinical the clinical gestalt of a record, because the coder's in a bind. The doctor wrote it down. You know, the doctor's the captain of the ship.
Right.
You know, and they're supposed to code what the doctor wrote. The AHIMA practice brief says that a query may not be appropriate simply because clinical information or clinical picture does not appear to support the documentation in the record. The solution to this is a very healthy peer review process, because if I as a nurse or I as a coder see something, and, you know, if it waddles, quacks, and has feathers, but the doctor calls it a horse.
Right.
You know, that becomes a peer review issue. And this is, again, why CDI programs that function well have physician advisors that can be, a second look and may be able to discern a clinical situation that at least is defendable retrospectively, or can be a conduit for referring that record to a peer review process that becomes an educational opportunity for the physician rather than just letting it slide and handling it retrospectively.
Right. Okay, yeah, we have physician advisors that get involved. You know, but to me, we were spinning our wheels because it kept going back and forth. And, you know, if that's how it goes, that's how it goes. But that's good. We'll make that an educational.
Yeah, what makes this hard is, like, let's take, for example, sepsis. A paper came out last fall that said that only 14% of physicians agree on the definition of sepsis. The definition of acute kidney injury is all over the place as well. And having your physician advisor and a good, rigorous peer review process helps solve this up front.
All right. Sounds good.
Thank you
very much, Dr. Kennedy. Getting close to the top of the hour, we do have some people in the queue. We'll take at least one more. I would encourage, if you're in the queue with a question that we couldn't address, you can email that to me at bmurphy@cdiassociation.com. Or I would also encourage you, for those who might not be using CDI Talk, they might want to ask it on that forum as well. That's been very helpful. But again, we'll get to at least one more of these, and could you put them through, please, Doug?
Certainly. Our next one comes from the line of Jerry Clark. Please proceed with your question.
Yes, this is Sherry Clark. What I was calling about was I wanted to get the contact information of the last caller who was discussing the RAC request. She had made comments that the RAC had requested her queries. And of course, they, even though they weren't part of the legal record or legal chart, and so we were just wanting to get the contact information for that caller.
Okay. If the caller's still out there, it's possible they've hung up, and if that's the case, unless Doug has a record of who that person was, it's going to be hard to know that. But if they're still on the call, caller, and you want to email me your contact information, I'd be happy to share it. And ma'am, who's on the call right now, you know, feel free to email me after the program, and I'll put you in touch with them if I can, in fact, get their contact information.
Okay, I certainly will. I'll do that tomorrow. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Doug, why don't we take one more, and then we'll have to wrap up here.
Okay, our last question comes from the line of Danietta Henry. Please proceed with your question.
Oh, I just had a response in regards to the possible probable diagnosis at the time of discharge. We have a lot of, conflicting impressions of what that means here at our facility. And, you know, for instance, here's an example. you know, a physician may document possible pneumonia for the first 2 to 3 days, put the patient on a pneumonia standing protocol, continue the IV antibiotics all the way through discharge, never say no pneumonia. And, you know, some people say it should be coded. Some people say it shouldn't be coded because he didn't mention it again. So, I mean, we kind of, you know, I don't know, it's not only mentioned just on the day of admission as an admitting diagnosis, it's mentioned again a couple days afterwards. The patient may have been here for 5 days, and they mention it for the first 2 to 3 days and continue the treatment. And there's some impressions that it still qualifies as a possible diagnosis at the time of discharge because the treatment continued, and there was no mention to state that the condition was ruled out or did not exist.
Okay, thanks for sharing, ma'am. Any comments, final comments?
I think if I could jump in here, Brian.
Yep.
When I'm out on the floor, particularly at the small community hospital, I can actually get to see physicians because there's not 100 physicians on staff. I try to get with the physician as opposed to leaving them a note and use that as an educational to say, you know, if you're treating the condition and you still think the patient has it, as part of your documentation for your own billing, which the record represents, obviously, as an inpatient stay, that's the medical record, is the progress notes for the doctor in case he's requested from a third contractor or whoever, insurance company, whoever, to validate his leveling, that every day that he's treating a patient for a condition, it ought to be included as part of his documentation to substantiate the E&M that he's actually billing for that day. So I try to circumvent guessing whether it's there or it's not there by using that as an opportunity to educate the physician on the importance of following through every day for diagnosis that he's still concerned about and medically managing.
All right. Thanks for sharing that, Glenn. That sounds like a good approach.
Brian, Jim Kennedy, just again want to emphasize to everybody, Coding Clinic, third quarter 2005, page 22, is what a RAC will likely use if they challenge a CC or MCC that is uncertain on admitting or is an interim diagnosis and is not documented at the time of discharge. And
okay.
If somebody has a coding clinic that can deal with that, I'd like to know what it has to say.
Okay. Well, again, we appreciate the references, and I know you advocate if a CDI department doesn't have access to coding clinic, they should, you know, go to your coding department, you know, ask for a separate subscription or access through your encoder, because I know how important that is. At this time, we're at the top of the hour, so we're going to be ending the call. I appreciate all the comments. I know we didn't get to quite all of them. We didn't get to a few of the pre-submitted questions, but we did receive a few answers, and I'm going to try to share those with the membership either in a blog post or an upcoming issue of CDI Strategies. One was related to whether a patient can have sepsis and bacteremia coded. Another one was about establishing definitions of severe malnutrition. And Dr. Gold, who was not on the call, had some good thoughts on that that I'll share with everybody. So. Again, I appreciate everyone who dialed in. Thanks very much to our advisory board for all your expertise today. These are, again, offered every quarter as a service to ACTUS members. And after the call, usually within 2 to 3 days, we have the recording posted on our website. You know, those are there permanently as a way to you can go back and listen to old ones. And so if you've missed something on the call, you dialed in late, in a couple of days, we should have that recording up for you. So at this time, you can hang up and enjoy the rest of your day.